All there right.
You go.
Let's do this thing then. Welcome back to another episode of Beyond the Check Service Industry Podcast, where we talk about all things service industry related and whatever else I feel like talking about. If you haven't yet, please go watch my television series, Beyond the Check Worker Earner Edition, now streaming on Amazon Prime and Tubi TV. Tubi TV, it's free TV. Yeah, go follow me at Rashawn Parker, R-E-Y-S-H-A-N, Parker everywhere, and Beyond the Check everywhere. Yeah, cool. Awesome. I have a wonderful guest today. He's a fantastic chef, human being, and podcaster at the Culinary Libertarian. I say that right?
You did.
The Culinary Libertarian.
With dramatic pause between.
Very dramatic. I was a thespian in high school, so.
Acting. You old enough to remember the John Lovitz scenes, but. Master Thespian?
Oh, yes. Master Thespian.
As I'm realizing as I advance in my time on this planet that there is an entire era that more and more groups of people have no idea what that is. I look at me like, what? Saturday Night Live started when?
Yeah.
It was like dinosaurs, man.
There's a lot that people don't know now. So it's actually a good time to just bring it all back because all the millennials have no idea what it is. And they think it's super cool, whatever it is, right? I'm like, oh.
Well, it wasn't all super cool. I lived through a lot of that. But that's another story.
I mean, the rotary phone, you know, they don't get that.
That was cool. I took one apart. I wondered how it worked.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm pretty sure I took a few apart when I was a kid. Particularly, you know, because you could twist off. That's how you used to bug the phone, right? You twist off the receiver.
Well, you could bug the phone. You could hide things you didn't want found.
Man, the old phone, you can't hide anything in the new phones.
Nope, can't even get into them.
Nope. Ladies and gentlemen, Dan Reed.
Hello there. Who is that guy talking?
He's got a really cool voice and seems to know a lot about older stuff.
Yeah, well, it's because I'm old.
Oh, you're not old. You got less gray than I do.
That doesn't mean anything.
It means you're looking good, sir.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
It's because I have no hair. That's why I have less gray.
Well, I mean, beard-wise, you know, I mean.
Yeah, maybe.
I'm going full. I'm working up to full-blown white.
Just in the very front. It's weird. But who cares?
Yeah, I don't know. Anyway, how you been?
I've been well.
Well, that's good. How's sunny Cali?
Well, I have no idea because they're south of me, but sunny Oregon finally
came
back yesterday for about 10 minutes. We got a dusting of snow.
What?
And cold temperatures.
It snowed?
Yeah.
Does it do that often?
Only in the wintertime.
Yeah.
But it's been we're experiencing now. I know there's weather words for this, and I don't know what they are. But we're going through one of those weird ocean cycles, and it's really strange that we're getting ocean warmth on this side of the mountains. I'm on the east side of the Cascades, and usually I don't live in the mountains before, but the heat is kind of climbing over the mountains and settling in. Where I live is a giant valley. It's called a basin. I don't know where basin starts and valley ends, but it's this gigantic valley, and we're warm, where it really shouldn't be because we're not getting the amount of snow we would want to have during the winter so that we have water during the summer. So last summer was a bit of a drought problem. This summer is looking like it, unless we get 7 feet of snow in 2 weeks, we're going to have a problem.
So the California drought weather has worked its way all the way up to Oregon, huh?
It seems to, and I'm sure it's not that simple. But like I said, I don't know weather things, and this isn't my strength. But I just know that
it's going to affect the crop somehow.
It will affect the crop somehow, and probably in a bad way. And I don't particularly care for driving in snow. I don't particularly care for driving on icy snow roads.
Oh, I really actually miss driving in snow. It's weird.
You can have it. I
miss a stick shift, and I miss the stick shift, and I miss just taking those, you know, just letting the car turn itself, you know? Like, if you know how to drive in snow, it's actually a lot of fun, right?
But and my 15-year-old daughter is learning to drive, and everything nowadays is front-wheel drive, which is fine. Partly because we get snow so seldom, and we live in what's called a high desert, so it doesn't rain very often in the summertime. When it does, it gets really slick, and people generally don't know how to drive.
That's
part of the problem. They don't know what to do when the roads are slippery. And so even if you know how to drive on a snowy road,
you can't trust the other people.
You got a big problem. But I used to go skiing in high school in northern Michigan. And my car was a full-size station wagon, rear-wheel drive. They had no such thing as studded tires at the time. And I think, how did we go anywhere? I just got in the car and went. I didn't care. Like, I'm frozen to paralysis with thinking about doing that again. That's why I know I'm old, because I'm like my dad. I'm not driving that crap.
I mean, I remember having to like follow the tracks in front of me, right? Like,
yeah.
So when I went to college, I went to Ohio University, and so it's like the beginning of the Appalachians, right? So it's a very hilly town, and it's Ohio, so it still snowed a lot. So in order for classes to be canceled, the dean had to declare, or he literally couldn't get out of his driveway. So if it was a level two, you still had to go to class if the dean could get out of his driveway.
Makes sense.
And if it was a level three, that was the only way schools were getting closed, because that's like, you're not allowed to go anywhere. But I remember many, many, many a days just following the tracks in front of me super slow, just to like get to class in a level two snowstorm, because the dean is too much. And yeah, he probably had four-wheel drive too. Fucking asshole.
Maybe. Who knows? Yeah, I don't think I was in northern Michigan in the blizzard of 78, and we lived on a street called Hill Street, but they had to use, you know, those giant construction graders. That's how they had to plow the snow. Nothing else could get through. And the bank of plowed snow was about 10 feet high. Ooh. They canceled school for that. But generally in northern Michigan, I don't
know. No.
Remember them? Like, there's 2 feet of snow. What's wrong with you? You're going to school.
Oh no! If it flurries here, if it gets cold enough to flurry, they will close schools in Georgia.
It's funny.
Like, seriously, yeah, 27 degrees, close it. Can't have the kids come out in this weather.
No way, man.
No way. But they don't even get like the snow day. It's just like they're just off, and it's cold. I don't know what they do. Yep. They watch Netflix at home and play video games. Anyway, let's talk about some food.
Okay.
What started your culinary journey to chefdom? Was it inspiration from a family member who cooked as a child, or where'd you?
No, my mother was probably a pretty decent cook, you know. And I lived to survive it. She wasn't an amazing cook, but she did a good job, and we liked the food, so we ate it. Nobody in my family was in the restaurant business, and I knew nothing. It's like I knew nothing of the restaurant business at all. I had no idea what it was like, and you certainly can't get at the time. The only people to watch on TV cooking were Graham Kerr. He was just fun to watch.
Was that the old Southern dude?
No, that was the Galloping Gourmet.
But he always wore like a blue shirt. He's has kind of a Texas accent.
No, Graham Kerr definitely.
No, it's not Graham Kerr. I've been trying to remember who this guy was. My grandfather used to have it on all the time, and he'd just be like, woohoo! And he'd add some hot sauce and be like, yeah!
It sounds like Justin, the New Orleans guy. Justin was funny. Justin was
he was
fun.
Like he was like an older guy.
Yeah, it sounds like Justin. Bigger. I don't remember his last name.
Oh man, but woo on PBS.
Like a bolo tie.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's Justin.
That's Justin something. I'm gonna look that up.
Justin
later.
Something. He was fun, but So either that or Julia Child, that she was on PBS. So I really truly had no idea what it meant to work in a restaurant. So I got a job, you know, as a busboy, but never as a cook. So I thought this was a good idea. I thought it would be an easy job.
Busing? Sure.
No, cooking.
Oh, cooking. So no, definitely not.
Boys and girls, for you playing at home, restaurant cooking is not an easy job. It is not 40 hours a week. It is not, oh my gosh, look, it's 5 o'clock. I got to go home.
Yeah, it's so 5 o'clock. You just got to work.
You just got, yeah. We haven't even started yet. So there was no familial historical basis for this decision. It just sounded like something that was interesting. I liked eating. I had no idea how to cook. I certainly didn't know how to bake anything and ruined more stuff than I succeeded at. And still did it anyway. So in Michigan, in the Detroit area, there were a couple of culinary schools, and I went to one of them. And you know, 19-year-old logic is boy logic. 19-year-old male human logic is a particularly odd thing because it isn't logic at all. So this particular 19-year-old was going to school, paying to go to school to learn from these pretty well experienced instructors and chefs, but I also had a job at a fairly well-known in Detroit area restaurant, and Detroiters will know the name Douglas. He was a Chadsey High School superstar named Doug Grech, and in his heyday, and now again, he's a pretty good cook. So a 19-year-old says, well, you know, I'm being paid to work and learn about food, or I'm paying to go to school. Well, duh, obviously quit school and go to work.
Right.
Well, so that was the decision. And all these years later, I don't really regret the decision because the course over 40 years, and we're not going to go through all that, was I met some and worked for some extraordinary people. So I don't regret the decision quitting school. But My focus ended up sort of all over the place. It took a while to get my feet under me because everything looked interesting, and everything can be interesting, but eventually found my way to really being immersed in classical French cooking. And not just to say that you've done it, but to really dive into it. And that's You need some specialized training and some specialized people to get to that level. And I just bought in and went completely way, way down the rabbit hole of classical French cooking.
With probably a lot of rabbit.
Well, a little bit of rabbit.
A little bit of rabbit.
A lot of beef, but a lot of pain, a lot of hours, a lot of sweat, a lot of cuts, a lot of burns. There's
Julia Childs wasn't enough, huh?
Oh no!
No.
So she was good, but I know that I wouldn't necessarily recommend it. I wouldn't be an advocate to say you have to go. Young cooks have to go learn to do this because
you don't.
It's hard, and you know I don't know very much about playing tennis other than the fact that I know that I'm very, very bad at the game, but I also recognize there are people who are spectacularly good, and I'm from an era where John McEnroe was the guy. But
and a super entertaining guy to watch too.
And an entertaining guy to watch, but a fantastic, amazing, skilled tennis player. Now, maybe part of that was just his DNA. Who knows? But there's something about excellence. And so, you know, I often talk about Michael Jordan. Whether you like Michael Jordan or don't like Michael Jordan, it's pretty hard to argue that he was bad at his job. Michael was a spectacular example of what an NBA player can accomplish, or a human can accomplish, with, well,
those shoes.
Committed effort. It wasn't the shoes.
It wasn't the shoes.
So Johnny Mack or Michael or anybody you hold up in a craft or a skill as excellence, put a lot of time into that. Kobe Bryant the same way. And I don't really follow Kobe, but I've come to discover that Kobe had a work ethic that was mostly unrivaled by contemporaries in the NBA. Now, I don't know if that's a factual statement, but Kobe worked hard. Kobe earned the things he got. So to earn the level of craftsmanship necessary to succeed in classical French cooking means, at least in my experience, you surrender a dozen years of your life to a stove. You get married to an inanimate object.
So did you spend 12 years just learning French techniques specifically?
Not just specifically. I worked where I could get the job, but worked with people who focused on that. So, and sometimes there were breaks, but I came back to it again and again and again. And then when I ended up after all that time, I turned that cooking experience into teaching. I worked at a private community college in Tallahassee, Florida, teaching culinary arts. And I can't reach it, but up in that corner is my copy of Le Guide Culinaire, well tattered. The binding is kind of torn. It's got little sticky notes in it from 30 years, well, no, not 30 years ago, but many years ago. Lots of passages are underlined from heavy, heavy use and heavy use for reference and for getting into it. And the chief purpose, as I see it, from getting an understanding of what classical cooking is, it's not to know all 5,700 recipes. That's fine, but that's just memorization. Really, it's
technique, right?
It's technique. So there is a way to make a stock. Now, there's a slight variation on the technique if you're going to make a brown stock, like a roasted veal stock or a beef stock, because you wouldn't want a white beef stock. That would not be a pleasant taste. There would be any reason to do that, since one of the principal reasons we cook is for flavor. So there are basics, fundamentals, and stock making. There are basics and fundamentals in sauce making. And all of those kinds of those basics and those fundamentals exist in meat cookery, fish cookery, chicken cookery, vegetable cookery, and yeah, you can cook fruits. So it's not that it's intimidating because it's 5,700 recipes. It's intimidating because Escoffier cooked for kings. So there is an obvious expectation that the king is going to get the absolute best that there is. That's somebody else's podcast, whether that's actually the case or not. But it's recognized that that should be so, at least if you're the king. So there is an expectation out of doing classical French cooking that it's going to be the best there is. Do you have to have truffles and foie gras to make classical French cooking? Absolutely not. There is a dish in there called Chicken Maryland. Oh my gosh, Chicken Maryland. It's fried frickin' chicken, folks. All it is.
Really?
No kidding. It's fried chicken.
It's just fried chicken.
It's just fried chicken.
Made the same way, southern egg, egg drenched in egg, yes, flour, and fried.
It's fried chicken.
Boom.
So it sounds amazing, but it sounds terrifying until you take the mystique out of it. So Chicken Maryland is fried chicken. So you can be fancy tonight and make fried chicken. Look, honey, I made Chicken Maryland.
And fried chicken crosses almost every ethnic cooking culture across the world. Almost every culture has a fried chicken.
That almost certainly has to be true.
Yeah, it is true. But
I would think possibly the Inuits may not have fried chicken.
Maybe not the Inuits, but like from China all to Russia to to Mexico, we are frying chicken.
There is
around the world
version of fried chicken, absolutely.
And the technique is inherently the same across borders. Does thinking about like other cuisines, so like the opposite of the world, they have different ways of even just slicing their vegetables, right? So if you go to Korea, like Korean housewives, Korean chefs, they don't slice things the same way that American trained chefs do. Have you ever noticed that? that there's not like one way to julienne an onion. There's actually multiple different ways. And you see them do it and you're like, you're doing it wrong. Right? But they're like, no, you're doing it wrong.
Well, now the onion thing is interesting because as the student in school being taught, now at the risk of generalizing, most culinary schools probably teach the classic French way of cutting in the onion, which obviously you peel it, cut it in half, put the root end down so that you're cutting it sort of through the equator. No, wrong words, through the poles, north to south. Turn it on its flat side. And they make cuts down, they cut sideways, and then finally chop it.
Yep.
And because this is what you're being taught in school, most students aren't going to say, no, I'm not doing that because I have to chop this onion to get a grade, and I have to get the good grade, blah, 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 blah. Fine, whatever. I understand that. But if you examine the construction of the onion for more than a second, you realize that it came to you already kind of pre-sliced.
Yeah.
You just have to figure out how to use its shape to your advantage. And there's a way to do that. And so when the first time I saw people either cutting julienne's by sort of following the shape of the onion, it's like, well, this is interesting. This feels wrong because my chef instructor said this is the wrong way to do it. And this is that statement. Right. I was taught something different.
So this is wrong.
Is a terrible, terrible statement, only on the face that there's no certainty that what you were taught in cooking, in law, in economics, in history, in writing was, quote unquote, the right way. Yeah. It was the right way on that day to get the grade you preferred from the person giving the grade for doing the thing they preferred. Now I don't know too much about Vietnamese cooking. I know a little bit about
they peel the opposite direction too. So like they do.
I noticed that. That's kind of weird. It's like watching a left-handed person cut with a knife. My fingers hurt because I couldn't do that. No, but watching them go quickly with a French knife, I just
So right, my wife. My wife's determined to cut all vegetables with a paring knife. It's so annoying to me.
I would be triggered by that.
And I find myself going, can you just do it the right way? And she's like, there's not a right way. Let me just do it my way. Like, but you're doing it wrong. And she gets so mad.
Is she there, Jordan? Can you hear this?
Yeah, she's...
Tell him if he wants to eat, you'll cut it the way you want to.
When I can get her to actually try to make something, yeah. So I just have to stay out of the kitchen, so I'm not there telling her she's doing it wrong.
Well, so you know, this is interesting because as the instructor, now I was kind of that dickhead about you're not cutting it right, and then there is a reason to put cooks through the process of learning knife skills. There are reasons that a piece of carrot cut too big and a piece of carrot cut too small is undesirable in a saute pan, because then the small pieces burn before the big pieces are fully cooked.
Right.
And that one is aesthetically bad, but even more important, it imparts a burned flavor into the food, and nobody wants that. So having a uniformity in your knife skills does actually serve a purpose.
Oh, for sure. I mean, you have to be able to, like, you know, use the knife before.
Yes. So you would want a surgeon to know how to use the scalpel. Well, I think the thing's here. What if we cut over here? Oh, damn. I missed. It's over here. So we want some training. Surgery is much more significantly important than whether or not you cut your carrots the right way.
I mean, I'm not going to. I have trouble piecing up a chicken still, like, and it's relatively there for you. The roadmap's pretty much on the chicken for you already.
It is. Well, you know? And so we went through at one restaurant in Southfield, Michigan. We used to get 160 chickens 80 at a time, twice a week, week after week after week after week. And it was a chicken cutting party. Everybody not doing something came over, got a knife, and you cut chicken. Let me tell you what, you learn real quick how to cut a chicken.
If you want to do it efficiently.
That was also a restaurant run by the first certified master chef, Milos Sihelka. Boy.
Yeah, it's a mouthful, Dan. It's a mouthful,
it is,
Dan.
And that was just water, as far as you know. Milos Sihelka escaped Czechoslovakia to come to Canada, then to the U.S., and was, you know, I've known a handful of certified master chefs, and some of them from the very old guard. Like, we're talking, you know, the old French, German, hardcore, meanie pants chefs.
So there was actually like a title given at one point of...
Yeah, the American Culinary Federation master chef. Hands out, you know, they don't hand out.
Award.
They award, although, and now I think it has been, I think the test has been diminished from what it originally was. But when it first was created, it was a 2 weeks adventure at the Culinary Institute of America. And it was brutal, absolutely brutal. And Brian Polson's, maybe his second book, follows, Brian Polson's the cook. I forgot the author. Anyway, Brian Polson used to be sous chef for Milos, and went, still has a place as far as I know, and sort of in suburban Detroit, went and took the test. Didn't pass, it's hard. But passing the CMC test is a really big deal. It means you can do damn near everything there is to do in the kitchen, including bake and pastry, which most chefs
do one or the other.
Yeah, and they can be amazing line cooks. They can manage 9 saute pans and the griddle. Everything comes out fine. Say, hey, I need you to go make some biscuits. No, I ain't that. I will cut off my foot and dissect it for you, and I will make a galantine from my toes, but I will not make a muffin. And there's something weird about how, and it works the other way around. You ask the pastry chef, I need you to go cut the line. I ain't doing that. I don't know what the hell to do. I don't know what a saute pan is. So there's this weird line where cooks, really highly skilled, amazing, technically proficient cooks, won't touch
the other
biscuit
side
or a muffin. No, I ain't doing that. No way.
Now, so, I mean, you see the people on MasterChef, right? And you ever watch MasterChef?
Yeah, that's the Gordon Ramsay show, right?
Yeah, yeah. I think it's all around the world now. But.
Yeah, I liked that show. I don't watch it much anymore. I don't watch TV pretty much at all anymore. But when it was on, I liked it.
I like the kid version better. They're much more friendly. I had a contestant on a couple weeks ago who was on season 3. And
those kids are amazing. The kids that cook on that, and there's one. Gordon's nicer to the kids, and it's nice to see that Gordon, I mean, he's got kids, so he knows how to be a nice person.
Yeah, and but the kids just nice to each other.
Yeah, yeah. But they can cook.
Yeah, like, it's amazing, right? Like, there's an 8-year-old.
Adults can't do that. Like, holy shit, man.
Like, making cocobound, and like, you fucking just ingredients I've never heard of, and you're 7. Like, come on.
It may have happened again, but the one I remember the most, and I don't remember who the kid was, and I don't know what the dish was, but what stood out to me was Joe took a bite of it, looked at the kid, put his fork down, pulled out $20 and said, I would pay you this right now for that meal. That's how good this dish is. I'm like, holy crap.
Right?
You get a guy going into his wallet because you cooked that well. Dude, you won the day.
It's not just a guy; it's Joe.
Yeah, Joe, he makes Gordon look like a saint. But that was like that's impressive. And then they
kids don't mess with Joe's grandma either. She's
no, I like Marcella. That's his mom or his grandma.
Oh, I think it's mom. But
I think it's his mom.
Yeah,
It was I don't want to think about his grandma. But yeah, Marcella Hassan, she was good. But Joe's a ball breaker, but I respect him.
Yeah, those kids though. When I was a kid, I was, you know, my crowning achievement was I could make brownies from scratch. Like I could take.
Hey, don't knock that. That's a big deal.
And it's just because I wanted brownies, right? And I wasn't really allowed
what
to have them.
What motivation do you need than I want to eat something than to go learn to do it?
Yeah, but if I could take the bitter chocolate and I could make my own chocolate, you know, sauce. God, I don't even know if I remember how I did it. But yeah, I would, you know, take that bittersweet, nasty chocolate because that's what was kept in our house because my mom knew that we weren't going to get into it.
Oh, you kept the baking chocolate.
Uh-huh.
Baking. Awesome.
You try to get into it and you're just like, oh, this isn't right. No.
That is not a pleasant experience.
So if we wanted chocolate, it had to be turned into edible chocolate.
See?
Otherwise, it was carob. And we had a ton of carob in our house.
Is your mom diabetic?
No, she's an herbalist. So, at my grandparents' house is where the cereal and the candy and the donuts and all that stuff was. But at home, it was bulgur wheat and buckwheat pancakes. And our candy was, I shit you not, lilacs. Is it the little purple flowers that grow in the yard?
Yeah, in spring, they're coming up.
Yeah, so she'd pick those, and she put a light sprinkling of sugar on them and bake them. Well, that was our candy. Maybe it was violets.
Violets are probably more common, although this is interesting. I have a lilac tree in back, and I didn't do it last year, but a friend of mine used to be a spectacular bartender. Anybody can pour out of a bottle. It's the mixing, yeah, and the mixes. So he made all of his own mixes, everything from scratch. I'm like, wow, I like this.
Bitters and everything?
Yeah. And so simple syrups, flavored simple syrups for as far as you can see. But one thing he didn't do, and I'm going to do this year, is make a lilac infused simple syrup to then figure out what to do and make that into a drink. Now,
some Saint Germain, little champagne, little lilac. Hey,
I think that's fine. I'm just, we got to figure out the use to do the rest of the champagne, which won't be hard. okay, so that's a good idea.
Gin also.
Well, see here, Oregon, on top of being a spectacular place for blackberries and hazelnuts and salmon. There are and beer, lots and lots and lots of small beer places. They have a few gin distilleries, and I like good gin. They make some amazing, like, holy crap, this is good gin.
Right, it's hard to like gin. I don't know, but I feel like gin is one of the tougher alcohols to like, unless you're going to spend, like, Hendrix is fantastic. Hendrix is like, this isn't gin, this is delicious.
Well, try right. these other things. So look for them, and because I'm here, it's easy for me to find. But I like juniper. I like that kind of foresty floral. I'm fine with, and I appreciate subtlety, but I kind of want punch in the face flavor. I want big and bold. So gin delivers on that because it's got that, I want that big juniper up front. But the stuff to do in here, it's obviously it's got the juniper, coriander and fennel and just on and on with the aromatics. I'm like, wow. It's like they knew what was coming.
And just a little spritz of absinthe.
Maybe. That's a big deal. That's coming back.
Yeah, that's the thing. A place called Seawolf in Tybee Island saw it in my show last year, and spritz of absinthe was a big deal to them. I don't know, just a spritz. It's not like there's a bunch of it. It's just like a little spritz that just gives it like that very light licorice.
Yeah. So like Pernod and Ricard are the same flavors, but I don't think they come with. I don't think they have the wormwood, which anyone has done their absinthe history. Yeah, that's some funky stuff. That stuff.
I don't think we can get real absinthe in America. Can we?
You know what? Honestly, I don't know. I think at some point, some years ago, whoever the they are who make those restrictions lifted those restrictions, and it used to be a worldwide ban on proper wormwood infused absinthe. I think that's gone. I think the closest you could get for a while was pastis, but I think absinthe is actually back, at least in France, and maybe here in the U.S. too. I don't know.
I think I did hear that, like, no, it's real. And I'm like, but it's still, I don't think it's as, I don't think it's what it was.
Oh, I will accept that.
I don't, you know.
If it's back, I am sure it is not as it used to be. And you can find go look at the Monet paintings and, yeah, why did he paint like that? Oh, well, wormwood. No, I'm not.
Could have been the absinthe.
Could have been.
I mean, he could have been on mushrooms too. We don't know.
Hard to say. He's not here to defend himself.
He's not. I mean, something made him cut his, or that wasn't Monet. Cut it because Picasso cut his ear off. Something. I don't know. You don't do that sober. I feel like you're not just like, you know what? I'm going to do it today. I'm going to cut my ear off. No.
Look how much I love you. Cut, cut, cut. that does sound bizarre.
It was, he did it. Probably the absinthe. I don't know.
Well, no, who knows?
Who knows? So lilac infused. You're gonna make that. You're gonna make a lilac.
I'm gonna make that, and I think so. The lilac and the aromatic gin and
Little Saint Germain, Dan.
You know what? I actually have a bottle of in the other room is Fernet Branca.
Which kind?
Fernet Branca. It's one of those. So in the lines of Saint Germain and what's the one that's made from artichokes? Cynar. So it's the digestif. So okay. This stuff, it tastes like, now they'll be mad at me, but I'm not wrong. It tastes a lot bit like cough syrup. And one of the myths about how it's made is witches and warlocks on the full moon, the seventh day of the seventh month, get together and they chant over the cauldron and make this stuff. It has
kind of like Jaeger, but that's warlocks.
Kind of like Jaeger, but this stuff I think is better. And Jaeger doesn't purport to have medicinal properties. It just makes your legs disappear. The Fernet Branca isn't made for more than just a shot of it. And it could be used as a mixer, but I just do a shot or half a shot for like the Waltons. Now, there's a show for you, old farts.
The Waltons.
It sort of undoes unwellness. So if you've imbibed too much the night before, you've had food poisoning, or you feel like the flu is coming on, a Fernet Branca, and you're all set.
Touche. There was a Fernet. You like Fernet?
I don't know what that is.
Fernet's a very herby aperitif. Again, like it's almost. You ever had like an echinacea tincture, or like? Or like an herbal tincture of any kind?
Probably not.
You're in Oregon. You should be able to find some somewhere.
Well, I probably could, but I don't know. I haven't looked for them. I'm sure they're here.
So it's almost just a very herb-based liquor. I don't actually like it, but a lot of people love it, and it's good for settling your stomach. It's good for it's actually a medicinal liquor. I think because it's mainly a tincture, really, is what it is.
Right.
But I grew up with tinctures. So, like, whenever we were sick, like, I was being fed alcohol as a child. I didn't even realize it. It was just like echinacea tincture when you have a cold. And,
you know, Vicks 44? That was booze. I mean, we all had that as kids, but it wasn't every night. You had it when you were sick, and it shot us on the comfort. Did the same thing. It's you sweat out the bad, and then you're fine the next day.
Well, you know what else we had? garlic oil rubbed on our feet and put into our ears.
Yeah, we didn't do that.
Yeah, that was a cold remedy as a child. We all stank to high hell.
But you were healthy.
The vampires weren't fucking with us. That was for sure.
You know, maybe part of the effectiveness of garlic on your feet was that it was preventative early form of social distancing. They didn't get close enough to you to make you sick.
Not the antibiotic properties of it at all.
You know, that joke 2 years ago would have been useless.
It would have totally been useless. Now it makes full
sense.
Now
it's funny.
Yeah. Garlic keeps vampires away and keeps you fully social distant. 6 feet is a lot farther than people think it is.
It is a lot farther than people think it is, and it's completely useless. But that also is another show.
Right. But still, I was impressed by somebody one day was at my house, and they're like, you think we're standing far enough apart? And I was like, I don't know. What? Yeah, sure. And he's like, well, hold on. Let me just show you what 6 feet really is. And he pulled out his he had a tape measure, and he's like, that's 6 feet. And I'm like, holy shit. That's far. Like, there's no way in hell that anybody's staying 6 feet away from fucking anybody.
Certainly not having a discreet conversation.
No. Or sitting at dinner or, you know, anything. I mean, I'm 6'2". So I just assume, like, if you lay me down that, you know, I'm taller than I think I am. That's the gist of that story.
You know, it's magic, though, when you sit down at a restaurant table. It's nullified.
Oh, yeah.
Because you're sitting. Or it's eating. Magic.
Yeah. And drinking. Yeah. As long as you're drinking.
Only when you stand up do you have to step back 3 feet.
it's logic magic. is not America's greatest quality. But alas, we will argue over the ins and outs of not being logical forever. I don't know. Common sense has been lost on
it never was common to begin with, but yes, it's pretty much gone.
But don't you're getting funnier by the second, Dan.
Am I? Well, keep me around longer, see what else happens.
So can you bake?
I can bake. In fact, later today as a restaurant baker, and then end up having jobs as the head bakers of restaurants. Commercial baking, of course, is for the most part a big, big fan of gluten. We like gluten. It makes the croissants nice. It makes the Danish nice. Makes the breads nice. It makes the cakes nice. And my wife has developed an autoimmune disease, and one of the things we've had to change to help her manage that is go gluten-free.
Really?
Yeah. So because I like things that are challenging, gluten-free baking is a challenge. Now,
I have a great cookbook for you.
Well, tell me in a minute. So when you bake with gluten, you can choose all-purpose flour, bread flour, cake flour, whole wheat flour, pastry flour. And then there's different brands in those categories, but the choices are rather small. You know, you're going to make bread, you're going to make bread flour. That's what you're going to use. And you can argue over this company, that company has 12% or 14%. Who cares? It doesn't make a difference. But when you go into gluten-free baking, it's not like you can just go to the store and get a bag of one-to-one gluten-free mix for all-purpose mix. You can, but... big secret, none of them are one-to-one. They say they are. Use this exactly as the same as your gluten-filled flour. Wrong.
Why is it wrong?
So I will speak from my experience and not call the company liars. I'm not sure that they're lying, but I'm saying from my own experience, replacing one-to-one didn't work. So my knowledge of what baking should be helps a little bit, but gluten. So, in the world of what's going to be a good challenge, gluten-free baking is a good challenge because there are easily a dozen, maybe 18 different kinds of individual grain flours you can use, apart or combined in particular ratios. Then either guar gum, which, who cares? Xanthan gum is kind of the big deal.
You ever try pumpkin?
Pumpkin flour? No, not yet.
Pumpkin just as the filler. So there's a great book called Brownies for Breakfast by Lynn
Bowman. You want to know something that's really amazing?
Huh.
Lynn's my next week's guest.
Oh, yeah?
On my podcast.
There you go. Now, Lynn's so, great. Yeah. She's going to yell at you.
She did. I spoke to her for an hour and a half. I've got to go through the. So yeah, her yelling was, "Get rid of dairy! Get rid of dairy! Get rid of dairy!" And exercise.
No meat. No meat. No meat.
And she wasn't. She was pretty cool. She said, "If you have to have it, a little bit." So
yeah. She made me promise I wasn't gonna touch cheese again, and I would just use vegan cheese. But I have epically failed. I am so sorry, Lynn. I'm going to try harder.
She got no such thing out of me, and I wouldn't have promised anyway. I would not have agreed to that because I'm a big cheese fan.
I was vegetarian at the time, so I was trying. It was just a month thing. I try to be healthier every once in a while. So, like, pull off a month. I try to eat vegetarian at least 3 times a week, like, just because I don't need to have all that meat. Like, there's plenty of good stuff that doesn't – I don't have to have a steak be the hero of my meal every day. And I just get sick of it. Like, I just get tired of chicken, steak, chicken, beef, chicken, pork, chicken, you know? And it's like, I need another animal to kill, or I just have to start cooking differently because I'm just so bored with the proteins, you know? I know that's weird. You ever get bored of the proteins? Because I'm bored of the proteins. The look on your face says no.
I don't. No, I'm, you know, one of the things that my wife and I go over, we don't go at it a lot, but she prefers a wider variety with greater frequency than I do. I'm perfectly fine having 2 or 3 or 4 eggs and bacon for breakfast pretty much every day. I don't mind that because I can. Because every day, the eggs are cooked a little bit different. So to me, it's a whole new experience where I can make them into an omelet. I'm perfectly fine with that. And I'll change it up now and again. So because she wants more variety of more things more often, I don't get tired of them because I can find so many ways to do those things. So the chicken can be roasted one day, then the leftovers are turned into chicken salad. And cut it thin, use it to stir fry, make it into a soup, make it into a fricassee or a pot pie mix, and then that has a couple of applications. So there's always things to do that, even though it's the same thing, it can be pressed into service in some other way with its accompanying items, makes it look like it's not the same thing. So
it's like Taco Bell.
I think the last time I went there on purpose was 78, maybe.
Wow. Well, they still have a million things on the menu and 5 ingredients, so you're not missing much.
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, I was a kid at the time, but it had. I remember my cousins complaining that Taco Bell had a particularly powerful fermentation process in all of our digestive systems.
It's actually got rated the healthiest fast food out there, like last year.
I don't know if that's true or not. I just know that the...
If you order properly, because...
Level of flatulence was off the chart. It was room clearing, eye watering, gag inducing. Like, we're not doing that again. So,
all right, stay away from the bell, Dan.
Yeah, I don't do that anymore. I don't do that.
They got a 7-layer burrito. It's just all pretty good for you. It's rice, beans, lettuce, cheese, tomatoes, sour cream, guacamole. Yeah. So it's just all vegetables, right? So I think it's the 7-layer burrito that got them the old healthiest thing, because
Could be.
it's all just compared to other fast food places, right? Not like,
Yeah, I think they're all. I think they all are the same level of bad.
why don't we have healthy fast food? Why don't we have healthy fast food? Do people think
It's.
that they just won't? No one's going to go to it, right? Like, or is it the co too not cost not effective, right?
Well, so that it sounds like a really it sounds like a good question, and it actually is a good question. It requires at least one explanation. What is healthy?
Fresh, not processed, right? Like, and I think the problem is that it's not scalable, right? It's not corporately scalable to be able to have, and that to be able to pull up to a drive-through window and get like a good kale salad and a farm fresh piece of chicken, right? Like, it's not scalable unless you literally had a full-on farm-to-table fast food restaurant, right, which just operated with all their local farms, and menus were all slightly different because maybe the ingredients weren't available, right? And so to make it the McDonald's cookie cutter corporate expansion is a difficult thing in and of
It
itself to
sounds like
do.
there's two things. Having a excuse me, having a fast food restaurant, there's and I don't there's a place in my town. It happens to be a Mexican place, and I don't know if it's a chain. I've never seen it before. It could just be that it's this one in this town, and they do one thing. This has nothing to do with the food immediately, but the place is immaculately clean. And
Shiny,
as a cook,
like an Apple store.
not that immaculately clean,
But pretty fucking clean.
but it's a restaurant. So when you walk in and you look at the back line, the griddle is clean. Now it's in use, so it may not be shiny metal, but I don't want that from a griddle. I know that that's not going to be the case, but it's not covered in drips and goo from the last 9 weeks. The stainless steel wall in the back is clean. I can see where someone had cleaned it down. The floor in the front is clean. The line, like if you go into a Subway, they have a line where they put stuff. And there's a place called Moe's, and it's the same idea. You send this down, this is
Assembly line
kind
food.
of piecemeal. Yes, that's the word. Thank you. Assembly line, but it's clean. And you don't really pay attention at first and say, wait a minute, this place is clean. Holy crap, this place is clean. I want to come back here. It's just because it's
I
because
feel
you
sanitary.
if Yeah, if they care enough to keep the place looking nice, then I feel that they care enough to make sure that the ingredients are well tended to. And that's thought it was true, but certainly is a nice visual comfort as the guest. It's like, wow, I want to eat what it looks like they care about the place. But it smells good. I walk in the place and it smells good. I DoorDash there. And I walk in and say, oh man, this place smells great. They're fast, it's clean, it's organized. They probably come as close as is possible to what you're talking about. Now I think the problem really would lie in because we're out west, it is,
You have the mentality.
well, it's, well, beef is obtainable. There are ranchers not that far from here. Now, part of the problem, part of one of the answers to your question about why is it not the case that you can just go and build a fast food restaurant that has fresh chicken and fresh beef? Part of the answer to that is the federal government and the Wholesome Food Act of 1967. Mostly for commercial purposes, you can't go to your farm down the street and say, I need a dozen chickens. I want two tenderloins. I want a half a cow. They can't do that.
They're just not allowed.
They're not, well, let's go back to that. Not allowed. That's a problem.
Like, why can't I buy fresh produce and and meat from my local purveyor.
Because your overlord said you can't.
My overload?
Overlords.
My overlords. Well, fuck them. Who gave them permission to be my overlords?
Well, now, that's also another show.
We're going to have to do another show, Dan.
No one gave it to them. They just flat out took it.
So, but restaurants, you know, we have a lot of farm to table, you know, restaurants around the country now. And, you know, is it a special license, you know, that, or does it need to go through Cisco? Is that the thing? Is it lobbyists holding on to, you know, their profits?
Well, what is coming from the farm that's being served at those farm to table restaurants? Is it protein or is it mostly produce?
I mean, I've been to several where it's all of the above, like where everything comes from the farm except for like the fish. Like everything. Or from local farms, right?
Okay. Now I don't actually have an answer to that. Who wrote the book? I can't remember the guy's name. There's a book about food freedom and liberty, and that's not the title. And I did have a blog post about it, but there's more than a few examples of farmers who went to have, you know, they butchered their own meat, mm-hmm. cooked their own meat, invited people for dinner, and the FDA and the USDA and or both showed up and shut them down.
For cooking their own product and eating their own product.
Yes, because it wasn't inspected.
That's just ridiculous.
So you in many, now I don't know, and I would actually, as the culinary libertarian guy, this is something I should know the answer to, so you've given me an idea for another show.
You're welcome.
What is the loophole here? Is there a loophole? How is this being done? Because it's a good thing to find out.
Maybe it's the processing center, right? So maybe the cows are going to processing and they're inspected at processing so that they can then be shipped out to the restaurants. I'm just guessing. I would shot in the dark.
That's possible. The what most people probably would find amazing is that 80%, and let's just be conservative and knock it down to 60, but I'm pretty sure 80 is right. 80%, 60% of the beef processed and sold in the U.S. comes from four companies.
That they're all just taking the meat from a whole bunch of different ranches from around the country.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. So the cow you're eating is more well-traveled before it was slaughtered and then after the case than you are. So when you read in...
Yeah, and that's a problem. That's the problem.
That is a problem, not the problem. It's when you read that E. coli was discovered in beef product in 27 states... It's not that there's 27 issues. It's that there's one issue at this gigantic factory mm-hmm. where the cross-contamination is so bad that it ended up in 27 different states making a couple hundred people sick.
Yep.
So.
And I'm sure those huge companies have lobbyists that keep the laws benefiting them.
The crony capitalism and the lobbyists and the circle jerk going on that allows that system to stay in place is obscene. It might be equally as bad as the pharmaceutical industry paying the FDA, the agency that inspects them, a fee so they can inspect them.
Yep.
No. Yeah, that's no kidding. No so kidding.
We paid for all those drugs too. So.
You ain't done paying, brother. You ain't done by a long shot. Part of the meat problem is that it's this corporate government monopoly in charge of where it's done and how it's done. But, mm-hmm. So one of the ways to advance – now, a farmer in Virginia named Joel Salatin butchers his chickens on his land. And it has stainless steel tables, a concrete slab, and possibly there's a roof with no walls to keep the rain and the sun off. And he has no inspectors on site, and he runs a clean ship, and he won't ship it to you. If you want Polyface Farm chicken,
you gotta go there.
To Virginia.
Huh.
Show up when we do butchering. You want it? Get here early.
But he somehow
when we're
got
done, we're
he,
done.
He somehow got approved to do just that.
He's not approved. He doesn't need approval because sunlight turns out to be the best disinfectant there is.
Oh yeah, you know.
There is nothing better. And the FDA has challenged him on that, and he said, show me what's better.
And they can't show him.
Have a good day, Mr. Salvin. In Michael Pollan's book, The Omnivore's Dilemma, I think there's a whole chapter on it's actually a really good book because the last chapter is about he wants to make a meal entirely from his own hands, meaning not that he foraged all of the ingredients or participated in the butchering of the animals. And it's been a while since I've read it, but it's a fascinating read. And there's a whole chapter on Salatin. Joel is an animated character. He's got many of his own books out and is on one of the leading people in the fight against monopolistic control over food, particularly livestock.
Yeah, that's one of my mom's favorite books, actually, The Omnivore's Dilemma.
Well, it's a good book. There's a guy from Kentucky, Representative Thomas Massey, has introduced into Congress a bill called the Prime Act, which they always mean some words. I don't remember what the title means, the acronym is. But basically what it is to allow your local farmer, rancher, give him permission to butcher cows at his location and sell you the meat. Now, in Oregon, I know that there's a pork producer. She's not far away, and I can get pork from her. And I need to contact her and find out what is it exactly that allows her to do that.
Yeah, you should just have her on your show.
Maybe I should.
Dan, what do you have? What do you have? What are you having for dinner tonight? Maybe pork.
We are probably going to have some steak. And then my wife bought some asparagus. So we'll have asparagus and the kids. I'm not sure what they'll have. They don't want to eat with. They don't eat what I make. They don't want it.
How dare they? They'll learn when they get older.
Well, we'll see. 15-year-olds still won't eat asparagus.
No. I think it took me till I was in my 20s before I really liked asparagus. But tastes come over time. You know, you just got to keep trying, and eventually, you never know. You might like it.
The 10-year-old starts to like things, and one of the things. I don't mind that they don't like it because it just means more for me, and I'm okay with that. this is good. Like, crap. I mean, yeah, great, but crap. Now I got to make more.
Nice. Ladies and gentlemen, you have to go hang out with Dan some more on his podcast, The Culinary Libertarian. This man is a wealth of knowledge. You want to give any shout outs?
Oh, well, sure. The best place to find everything is the culinarylibertarian.com. So you can find headers for recipes and the podcast and my cookbook, Cooking for Comfort, One Pot Meal You Can Make, and you can do them. It's very simple. And that's probably all I got.
Awesome. Go get Dan's book. Listen to his podcast. Dan, thanks so much for hanging out with me.
It's been my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, anytime, sir. Anytime. And enjoy your dinner. I hope the kids don't like it.
Me too.
Awesome. Well, cheers, buddy. You have a wonderful rest of your day, and I feel like we have so much more to talk about. We'll have to do this again sometime.
Oh, okay. Not a problem.
Awesome. All right, buddy. Well, have a wonderful rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
Cheers, sir.
Thanks.
Rock and roll.